Good evening, this is Mae Brussel. The title of this one-hour broadcast is World Watchers. It is program number 806, July the 27th, 1987. This past week, we had an opportunity to hear George Shultz testifying before the Iran-Contra members of Congress, investigating the whole muddy affair that is getting muddier all of the time as these various witnesses begin to expose the operations of each other. And as George Shultz was talking about his being squeezed out of the operation and pushed aside, he being the old establishment team, formerly president of Bechtel Corporation, advisor to Eisenhower and to Nixon on various cabinet positions to Nixon, and brought into the Republican team by Ronald Reagan, but he was being squeezed out as the military and the secret team took over, giving less responsibility to the older established politicians that had been around for a long time. And George Shultz talked about that very clearly this past week. On broadcast number 755, that was May 25th, 1986, just a little over a year ago, I did one broadcast on Shultz. And in that broadcast, I said that George Shultz had to shape up or he was out. In fact, I did another broadcast titled, "Is George Shultz Dead?" In terms of he's completely dead as far as the secret team was working, and they had excluded him from major operations. I cited an article in the Washington Times called "Oust the Shultz Movement." This was August the 2nd, 1985, just 2 years ago, and it cited 25 conservative organizations set up by Richard Vagary, the head of the Young Americans for Freedom, the group that helped put Ronald Reagan into office, and a lot of pressure of the hard right movement to get George Shultz out, and Shultz is no flaming liberal. Then there was a full-page advertisement in the Washington Times, August the 17th, 1985, with large letters, "Mr. President, you have been badly served by George Shultz. He's working with Marxist-Leninists in Mozambique." And this is Oliver North and Robert McFarlane and Admiral Poindexter pushing Shultz out and calling him a Marxist-Leninist, as they want the secret government to be even more secret. And then the Washington Times had another full-page ad that same time period, a week later. This was September 23rd, 1985, titled, Shultz Policy, He's an Ally with Marxism. Then all of a sudden, after the 1985 period, they worked over George Shultz. And then there was an article, large article, "Libya Raid, a Triumph of Shultz Policy. He's America's number one hawk." And at the time, I said he either had to shape up and become as far right as them, or he would be out, and they were going to move around him. And that's what he was testifying about this past week, which coincided exactly with the dates that I was trying to explain this to people that listen to World Watchers. Also, that same broadcast, May 25th, 1986, I cited some information regarding a lawsuit in California in Santa Cruz County, a Muhammad Khalish Lee, L-E-I, who filed a suit May 6, 1986, saying that a man affiliated with the CIA told him, in quotes, "We have a problem over in Ethiopia, and we want to take some people out." And the method that he said that is there would be poisons put into spirulina, into algae that the people ate, and the poisoned algae would be produced in Bakersfield, distributed to northern Ethiopia around a Lake Tano area. He refused to do it, and because he refused to do it, he lost his status as a student from overseas and was not able to continue at Cabrillo College. That was a year ago this May. Just it passed 2 weeks, July the 3rd, 1987. There's an article in the San Francisco Chronicle, "Algae Offers a Way to Ease Hunger. Lake Turkana, Kenya. Scientist Stephen Ngunya dreams of a massive growth of weed as an end to African famine. The Kenyan botanist suggested that they send to Ethiopia this algae. Spirulina is not a new discovery. The Spanish conquistadors found it used by the Mexican Aztecs, and spirulina fans tend to be enthusiastic about it." And this article is about easing hunger in Africa, and a way was devised to end the famine, and they would begin in Ethiopia with this algae. And this particular person who came from the area felt that a year ago that there was evidence that this solution to African and hunger could be genocide. And a year later, I see that this becomes the great solution to give these people a chance to eat the algae and wean the population from fish that they're dependent upon or meat and make them accustomed to the spirulina. So we'll see what the death rates are in Ethiopia or Africa about 4 years from now. It's too soon to tell. Now, all of the articles about George Shultz calling him a Marxist-Leninist came from the Washington Times, a newspaper owned by Reverend Moon. And there was a long article, July 20th, 1987, in the San Francisco Examiner, titled "Evidence Points Oliver North's Ties to Reverend Moon." Now, the Tower Report had a list of names and banking connections that North used, and it had CAUSA, C-A-U-S-A, there. And so far, the National Wire Services and the investigators haven't even touched the connections of Reverend Moon because he's part of that inner secret team working against the established elected officials. And this one article goes into some of the connections of North to Moon. And it said from mid-1984 through 1985, when the Boland Amendment was in effect, Moon sent $1 million in supplies to Nicaragua around the Contra bases. And 6 weeks after North recommended establishing a tax-exempt foundation to send weapons to Nicaragua freedom fighters, they call them, he formed what was called the Nicaraguan Freedom Fund. And the Washington Times publisher, Bo Hai Pak, one of the top Moon political lieutenants, established a fund with the identical name, the Nicaraguan Freedom Fund. North had an institution by that name, and the Moonies had one also. A note found in North's files links PAC and CAUSA, that's the organization that was named in the funding charts that he had, the name of the Moon-dominated political groups to Oliver North. They were linked and to the Contra support network. One of CAUSA's USA's advisory board members is a controversial San Francisco priest, and his name is Tom Dowling, and I'll be doing more on him now. And his research outfit got $100,000 from a Contra leader and from a company that North used to launder Contra aid. A 1978 Senate subcommittee investigation on Moon's behalf in the United States, the influence buying, said that Moon affiliates made up a single organization whose goal was worldwide theocracy under Moon's unification church. And this, again, is the Poindexter North team that you see testifying that they make the proper decisions and they're the top persons. They don't have to tell the president what they're doing. And they're both very closely linked to the goals of Reverend Moon's Unification Church. This article says each Moon-linked organization insists it is independent of each other, but officials of the organizations acknowledge helping to provide hundreds of thousands of dollars in what they called humanitarian aid. Tom Ward is the chairman of CAUSA in New York City. A book published in 1986 called Inside the League, that's the World Anti-Communist League, by Scott Anderson and John Anderson, said Moon affiliates spend millions of dollars since the early 80s. They promote the Contra cause. They work with far-right military and political forces. In Central America, Moon supporters are influencing and influential in several countries that have supplied secret Contra aid, such as Taiwan and South Korea, Moon's native country. Moon recently had been imprisoned on an income tax evasion bout. While in the prison, he did work that was crucial for the Nicaragua government. Two Washington Times reporters have been aides at the National Security Council in the Reagan administration, and that's very interesting that a newspaper owned by Reverend Moon had two aides from the Mooney organization in the National Security Council in the Reagan administration, and one of them is Latin American specialist who worked closely with Oliver North from 1981 to 83, and then, of course, they went under after the Boland Amendment and continued to work and have their contacts. But before that, they were relatively above board if you wanted to know who they were. There was a report from Bob Howell, a member of the Mooney Connections. He says, I've heard no mention, of course, in all these months of a connection between the Iran-Contra Committee, the House investigation, and the Moonies. You haven't brought it up, which is true, but the Congress, the House and Senate, are protecting the Moon organizations, and then they went on to say there is a close series of connections between Reverend Moon supporters and retired General John Singlaub and the World Anti-Communist League. And, of course, Singlaub was one of the witnesses who was treated so gingerly, and he had access in and out of the National Security Council, the Pentagon, and as a retired general, can work with the Mooney Organization and with the World Anti-Communist League, all on the same goals, all working together. And this article says, goes on about the Nicaraguan Freedom Fund, which is a tax-exempt corporation with the identical name as the one that the Moonies started, which is hard to separate. In May 1985, just after the congressional vote where money was cut off, the Washington Times launched for the Contras. The Washington Times launched a $14 million Contra aid deal called the Nicaraguan Freedom Fund. The Moonies, with $100,000, started with their publisher, Mr. Pack. And the next link between the Moonies was Oliver North's April 18, 1985, thank you letter on National Security Council stationery. North Secretary Fawnhall wrote the letter to Phil Mabry, a Texas supporter. The Tower Commission founded in North File. Mabry is an official of the Moonies. On the letter were handwritten notes linking members of North Network and conservative activists with weapons, funds, and trips to Germany and to South Korea last year with the organization CAUSA and Colonel Pak, Bohai Pak. Mabry later acknowledged he received the note. A spokesman for Pak's CAUSA organization denied any other links to North. One member of CAUSA-USA, the advisory board, is in San Francisco. That's the clergyman Tom Downing. And he went to Congress and testified on the needs of the Contras wearing a Catholic priest outfit, disguised as a Catholic priest. And he actually works for the Moonies. And he goes down to Central America and says mass for the Contras in Honduras. He makes speeches around the United States under CAUSA sponsorship under Reverend Moon and also under the sponsorship of Oliver North. And North arranged his speeches. Dowling is an executive of the Latin American Strategic Studies Institute. His colleague, Neil Barrington, said all of the Contras money came from North-funded Contra leader Adolfo Calero and IBC, and yet it's very much linked to Oliver North's entire relationship with the Moonies, and it is Reverend Moon's newspaper that was calling George Shultz the Lenin Marxist, and large articles on why he shouldn't be in the State Department, because they wanted to clear him out so that Poindexter, North, Casey, and others, the secret team, could have access to as much time to do the operations they wanted around the world. And Mooney Organization is a world organization. The Washington Post had a story 2 weeks ago, July 3rd, 1987. Tongson Park returns with debt unpaid. Tongson Park is back. He was a key figure in the South Korean investigation of influence buying. He's very close to the Mooney, part of the Mooney Organization. He owes the government $1.2 million in taxes. He hasn't paid it, and he's never harassed about it. His new address is a house on Fox Hill Crescent, recently purchased for $634,000, but he has not paid off more than, it's not $1 million, it's $10 million in back taxes that he owes the United States. There's liens of $6.65 million, back income taxes pending. The liens are from assessments going back to the early 70s. The government did not issue another park company. The government did not pursue another company that he owns, Sutter's Tavern Corporation. He's the owner of a $1.2 million Georgetown Club property on Wisconsin Avenue. The IRS cannot explain why Sutter's Tavern assets have never been seized. So that the Moonies have a lot of influence in the Internal Revenue, with the parts of the government that don't harass them. And this article said Park returned to Washington periodically over the past decade. He has small parties. He has parties with the aid of money from the Korean CIA, and he so far has no criminal prosecution. Nobody has seized his assets. In 1977, he was charged with bribing members of Congress and getting legislation that was favorable to Korea. And this is a time period when Reverend Moon moved in with his newspaper and took over the mindset of the conservatives in Washington, D.C. But so far, any charges he has were dropped in 1979 and never continued. Park's family has been in the news in South Korea. Recently, his brother, Ken Soo Park, head of the country's largest shipping company, killed himself by jumping off a building under investigation for embezzlement of taxes in South Korea. But nobody's jumping off of buildings in the United States. And there is a lot of money available to these people and their organization. And they are linked to the Oliver North setup and the National Security Council and William Casey and so forth. I was talking last week about Kuwait and the flagging of the ships, the United States ships, for the very, very wealthy country of Kuwait, who seems to be buying up a lot of the land, real estate in America and Great Britain, corporations in Germany. And I asked the question, what does it cost to flag the ships for this very, very wealthy country that's really better off economically than we are? Well, on the Larry King program last week, Vernon Walters, our UN ambassador, was guest, and Larry King asked him what the cost was of flagging the United States ships in the Persian Gulf, and Vernon Walters made some dumb remark and smiled and wouldn't answer the question. The San Francisco Examiner answered the question Friday, July 21st. Gulf Armada estimated to cost $1.7 million a day for the United States taxpayers. And it protects Kuwait Oil Company, which is not an American company, which belongs to Kuwait. And it raises this confrontation with the oil countries, raises our price of gasoline. And then the price of gasoline goes to buy more weapons for these countries to fight each other. And they'll buy the weapons from us and other countries around the country. The United States is spending at least $17 million a day to maintain an armada of Navy fleets, fighter jets, and aircraft in the Persian Gulf. One of the reasons for other countries not participating, some are going to, but some of them not very much, was the explanation they didn't have the money. Well, we don't have it either. We have debts. And I think it's pertinent now to say what this cost, because there's been criticism of the Iran-Contra Committee and the prosecution charging many millions of dollars for investigating the crimes from the National Security Council, the CIA, the Defense Department, the White House. But the cost of the investigation is cheap compared to the cost of putting this money to keep these ships in the Persian Gulf. The cost, the CBS report estimated the annual cost of operating a giant nuclear carrier is $140 million a year just for one carrier. It could be cut to $120 million for a small non-nuclear constellation, but operating a cruiser is $98,000 every single 24 hours. The daily cost of the four ships is $400,000, and the cost of protecting the ships, the oil company in Kuwait, is $1.7 million a day. The Japanese don't spend that to protect the ships. They spend it in corporate money, buying up the United States as we go broke, defending the means by which they get their oil. There was an article in the New York Times, July the 9th, titled, "Fighting the Good Fight." North's view is that a band of patriots opposed by a hostile and unreliable world. It's written by R.W. Apple, Jr. It's a long article. I just want to cite several paragraphs of it. The witness was trying not only to justify his own behavior and that of the administration he served, but also to persuade the American public of the validity of its fundamental conviction that the Soviet Union and the United States are locked in mortal combat. And I'm sure you don't add up what mortal combat would cost this country, not speaking of other countries. Then there's another paragraph. In a sense, Colonel North's sharp exchanges with John Neils Jr., the committee counsel, represented another chapter in the prolonged struggle, which dates back to at least in the mid-1960s. That's just before John Kennedy was sworn in as president of the United States, over who controls American foreign policy. He, North, argued, as have presidents and other presidential aides, that the executive branch is supreme, and Mr. Neils argued that Congress had a role as well, and that the public had to know what was going on. Now, Oliver North's argument, because he's under Ronald Reagan, and he's the son that Reagan never had, they have so much in common, he said the president is supreme. But starting in the 1960s, Robert Mayhew was hired as part of the FBI, CIA, and the National Security Council to hire the long-known narcotics dealers and death squads under the tutelage of Santo Trafficante, Carlos Marcello, and John Rosselli. And the reason they were hired in just before when John Kennedy was running against Richard Nixon was that in case Kennedy, the president, didn't conform with the way that the military wanted the world to be run in the United States, then the president could be killed, and he was. So the president is not supreme, what is true. And he argues, who has the one who controls foreign policy is the president. He argues that. But that argument is wrong. The Defense Department has the contingency that if the president doesn't go along with the Defense Department, he gets his head blown off. And Oliver North is only saying the president makes decisions, but you heard John Poindexter testify. There were decisions he didn't have to tell the president because he knew what the president wanted. And when the president said, no, that isn't what I wanted, Poindexter said, you don't know what you wanted. This is the way it is. We make the decisions, and I'm an admiral. And the president doesn't have to be told what we think. So the contingency was made for somebody higher than the president, over the president, to make the decisions. And North isn't defending the president because they cut out the president of the decisions. North, the colonel, and Poindexter, the admiral, are defending the military decision for what they think is a mortal combat between the Soviet Union and the United States, and they are linked and prepared to die in the process of having this fight. Jack Anderson had a story this morning, July 27th, called A Shadowy World. And it's a very important article, but I just want to cite one paragraph, similar to the opinion in the New York Times article of what this is about. He said, we described William Casey in 1983 as a loner who operates out of his hat. He lives in a continuous state of crisis, whose mind is encased in a Republican hard shell, who talks of Soviet-American relations in terms of showdowns. Now, it isn't Casey's hat, a showdown that he wants. He learned that from being in the OSS. He learned that when Alan Dulles was working with Hitler's top agents in Bern, Switzerland. He learned that the road was set by 1943 for World War III. That didn't die with Casey. That wasn't Casey's hat at all. Casey was an instrument to make it possible in every country to get rid of any moderate people and put fascists in power and use their countries as bases all over the world to begin the showdown with the Soviet Union. And the things that I've been talking about on World Watchers many, many years are coming into prominence in the reading material that's being published by the newspapers daily, not by the television news, which is just terrible. But there is a lot coming out, and now they're specifying that there is this intentional goal of World War III, and that's what's on their mind. And the Unification Church is a one-world government, and Mooney is very much part of the NSC, with people from the Mooney organization on the board of the NSC and advising and tying together elements of World War II, such as Ryosha Sasakawa, who put the Mooney business together, and then the newspaper was a result of that. They have many publications. But this is a policy that was made before World War II was over, and to isolate it to North, to isolate to William Casey is wrong, but the intentions are very clear as they're printed in the newspaper lately. Now, Edwin Meese is going to start testifying tomorrow, and for many of you who get these tapes, he will already have been testifying, maybe be off the stand by then. And the Wall Street Journal had an article about him this morning. Meese's vagueness is expected to vex the Iran-Contra panel, who want to fill up the gaps, that he's not going to be able to recall events. He's going to be like Admiral Poindexter. He's going to be vague, and there will be significant gaps in the understanding of the affair. Now, many of the significant gaps will be because the members of the House Intelligence and the Senate Intelligence don't intend to give away their secrets of exploitations, of coups, of planned murders of heads of states. They just don't want it in the hands of a few, and also, when the hands of the few get exposed, they have to act righteously indignant so that they can then say that team is run amok, but we're different. So Schultz was vague. He remembered some things, but he didn't have to forget a lot because they didn't ask him hard questions. And when they asked him one, he got feisty and he changed the subject. Meese is something else because he was so close to always the president of the United States. He came to Washington from California and they had a particularly close relationship. In March 1984, and for about 6 weeks after that time, I started a series of broadcasts on Edwin Meese and the judiciary hearings on making him the Attorney General. He came in and became the Chief of Staff for Reagan at the White House, and then he was to replace William French Smith in 1984, and the Senate judiciary hearings were taking place at that time. On broadcast 639, this was 3 years ago, I had various items about Mies, one about Mies tied to the Superfund and making cleaning up pollution a political matter, delaying decisions that were causing cancer, and how he was on the board of Dart Industries with William French Smith and Northrop that were holding back money to clean up pollution that Governor Brown had been allocated to use because Brown was running against Pete Wilson for the Senate and they wanted Pete Wilson to win. This past week, July 27th, there was an article by Pete Wilson, "Oliver North is a Hero." And Pete Wilson also, I made the allegations in 1984, was for Central America funding of death squads and also death by chemicals. So he's defending North, of course, now, and I linked him 3 years ago to death squads in Central America. I also mentioned in that same broadcast Edwin Mies and the news media, that he didn't trust the news media, that an institute was formed in San Francisco called the Institute of Contemporary Studies of San Francisco. It was formed by Edwin Mies III, and he made no secret of his distrust for the press. And you may have seen articles this past week about the use of the Pentagon's secrecy to not take care of, to be on hand to see what happens in the Persian Gulf and the delay of people going out to the Persian Gulf, hand-selected by the Pentagon. Well, it was Admiral Poindexter and Oliver North who began with a grenade invasion by saying the only people that can be present at the time of a military invasion or altercation and so forth have to be hand-selected and pass the test of the Pentagon. And the very first day the ships are out, or 2 days later, there's a attack on one of the ships, a mine, and a lot of questions, how did it happen? It even seemed too coincidental. Well, this is the kind of provocation that Mies can set up with the Defense Department. He hated the press, and he worked along with Poindexter and North for secrecy. I also talked on that broadcast about Edwin Mies and Western goals and discussed the Reichstag possibility of a garden plot. Reichstag meaning that you produce or provoke an innocence, an incident where an agent provocateur or group of them cause violences, whereby you bring in the Federal Emergency Management System. And I cited an article by Ron Riedenauer in the L.A. Herald on Edwin Mies, a planned military takeover of the country. And April 30th, 1970, Mies and the California police were working with persons from Georgia, Washington, and so forth on the possibility of a coup at that time. Ron Riedenauer just came out with an article in Village Voice, the same material, on the FEMA organization Edwin Mies and how it goes back to Operation Chaos in California when Reagan was governor and Mies was in charge. And also I referred to Edwin Mies, the interest in reactivating the military position during Reagan's possible Olympics Reichstag operation. Now, the Soviet Union didn't send their athletes to California, and I believe that that would be the excuse for creating that federal emergency management that at the time Poindexter and North were very active in. We could kidnap the Soviet athletes and create an incident. And Edwin Mies had persons that he was putting into jobs in the Selective Service. He was with the Selective Service and was promoting and had access to draft resistors and so forth. He also had his hands on home loans, the post office appointments, and I was discussing Edwin Mies and the stolen Carter papers that were to assure Ronald Reagan's presidency. This was 3 years ago, on March 5th, 1984. This past 2 weeks ago, July 5th, the Houston Post had an article, "Reagan's Aides Linked to Theft, the Carter Papers." Now, that case has never been finished. It has to do with William Casey and a parallel government that, among other things, has been linked to the theft of briefing papers. This is just coming out now again, and I was talking about Edwin Mies' role to taking Jimmy Carter's papers with the help of the National Security Council. And now the name Oliver North comes into the picture of William Casey, and a lot of hanky-panky that took place that did, in fact, assure Reagan's presidency and assured that William Casey would become CIA director, and the links to the October 80 papers that were stolen, the briefing papers, are again in the news, and I was talking about those 3 years ago. We'll take a one-minute break and go back to or follow with things I had about Mies 3 years ago on World Watchers and update them with what I'm seeing in the news today and some important appointments and decisions Reagan has made in the past week that also link to the Edwin Meese affair.